Next speaker will be Carl Voss, who's been employed as a broadcast engineer in Phoenix, Arizona for the past 32 years at both the PBS KAET and NBC KPNX stations. Some of the many engineering-related hats that Carl has worn, and he's got a long list here, that he's worked for all broadcast-related equipment, including high-power transmitters, tower and antenna rigging, microwave path engineering, cameras and other studio-related hardware, fiber optics, computer networking, and security. He's been the chairman of the Arizona Frequency Coordination Committee, AFCC, for more than 29 years, and he created the Phoenix DMA's 2 gigahertz transition plan from analog to digital ENG for electronic news gathering that was used as a template for other markets to use in building their own transition plans. He trained the Phoenix law enforcement agencies on 2.5 gigahertz interference control between law enforcement and broadcasters. He worked with the Arizona 700 megahertz planning committee in educating both the law enforcement and Arizona broadcasting communities on the impacts of reallocating of TV channels 62 to 69 from broadcasters to law enforcement. He's also working on implications of the white space rules for FCC. And additionally, he's had frequency coordination he frequency coordinated the past 17 Super Bowls on behalf of the NFL and worked behind the scenes in creating the NFL game day frequency coordination program that I've been part of a few times in the past. And I'd like to invite Carl Voss. Welcome to our nice cool weather up here.
Push the right button for advancing the slide.
Well, there's an awful lot of frequency coordination stuff in there, so you're wondering, why is he talking about hacking or being hacked computers-wise? That's because my station did get hacked, so I'm kind of going to go through a little bit of background on that. As Keith was saying, that when they first invited me to here, it was over 100 degrees, 110 degrees, and I'm thinking, whoa, score, I can come up here and be nice and cool. Well, this week was the first week in Arizona that's been below 100 degrees, so I guess the best laid plans of mice and men don't work. A little bit of background here. The KAET, the station I work for, the station that got hacked, is affiliated with Arizona State University. So we get a lot of our data infrastructure through ASU. And that's really no different than any other station that's affiliated with a large organization, where you may or may not have direct access to the IT folks that are actually doing it. So what I'm gonna be talking about here is a broad overview of website vulnerabilities. You could go into details and talk for days on that. I'm going to also talk about what happened to KAET, our response to the event, what went right, what went wrong, and some of the lessons that were learned. I won't be talking about specifics about vulnerabilities. Again, you can spend days on all those sort of things. I also won't be talking about the actual forensics on how you go about figuring out where the bad guys got to on your servers here. There's also a little bit of background about this as far as PCI. PCI is the payment card industry standards that are dealt with as far as computer systems that deal with any sort of money. So if you deal with credit cards or bank accounts or any of that sort of stuff, there is a list of specs about that thick of stuff that your computer systems have to deal with in order to be PCI qualified. And all of this list about that much deals with personal information, which is names, credit cards, those sort of things. If you don't deal with personal information here, the rules that you have to deal with PCI are a whole lot less than you'd have to deal with if you're dealing with credit card information and personal information. Personal information should never be on any personal or publicly available web server. That includes things like names, addresses, social security numbers, bank account numbers, email addresses, et cetera, et cetera. So now that we've got a little bit of the background going on, KAET is generally PCI compliant, although all of our credit card stuff is dealt with, is outsourced. So we don't deal with any credit card information or any sort of banking information at all in our computer systems. The most that would happen if somebody would call our station up and say, I want to be a friend of Channel 8, we take the credit card number, it goes into the same credit card machine that you see at any sort of store, and you get a credit card information. None of the credit card information is ever stored on any of our facilities, which was a very good thing. We follow all the IT best practices. We back up the servers. We set up defense in depth, which is also something that really helped us a lot. So let's talk about the defense in depth. What that means is that you throw as many challenges in front of the bad guys as possible. It's like having a guard dog, a moat, and a lock on your door. Well, if you've got, you know, the bad guys, if they have to go past the guard dog, past the moat to the lock on the door, they're going to go next door who's got the door wide open here. So by having defense in depth, it helps minimize any implications on any hacking that happens to your machines. Administrative users are not allowed to, no user logins have administrative permissions, and all software runs under regular user permissions. This can be a real challenge because a lot of software folks write software assuming administrative permissions. They're basically lazy. If the software runs under total administrative permissions, they can do anything they want to that server, whereas if you get hacked and they break into your machine, you essentially have got, now the bad guys have total control of your machine here. In the original setup, under ASU, this is the internet. This is the entire Arizona State University campus, from students to classrooms, et cetera, et cetera. It's sitting behind a firewall here, and really all this firewall does is do network address translation so that we don't have to have real IP addresses, real internet IP addresses out in here. These are all private IP addresses, and this firewall does translations from when somebody asks for a specific web server, whatever, this translates it to the correct IP address here. There's a limited amount of intrusion protection and antivirus on this firewall, but it's by definition very limited because there are so many different types of users on this network, they can't sit there and do real restrictive scanning of data going through this firewall. The KAET broadcast plant is up here. It's sitting behind our own firewall here, which protects all the students, or protects our equipment here from all the students playing around on the ASU LAN, and also protects our equipment for those folks on the internet. Notice here there's a DMZ, an area where these servers could have been behind our firewall. When I started at KAET, this was a high priority to move these servers up onto this DMZ, but other things happened and they literally didn't get moved. As any university, we use student programmers. The challenge between using student programmers is they are not wise in the ways of proper security. They make it work, it works well, but they don't really deal with sanitizing input. And that's pretty much what got us. What does input sanitizing mean? It means that if you're asking for a name, and your database has got your name of 25 characters in here. That means you accept no more than 25 characters for your input. If somebody tries to put something in there longer than 25 characters, it's not going to allow that data into it. Our students did not do that. In addition, there was supposed to be no personally identifiable information on this publicly accessible web server. However, one of the staff folks went to a student that says, hey, it sure would be nice if the web server did this. And the student says, oh, okay, well, I need to put this database on it, put the database on the server, and nobody knew it was there, except the bad guys. So basically what happened? First of all, we're a PBS affiliate, and Frontline did a story on WikiLeaks. And the hackers did not like the story that PBS did on WikiLeaks. So they went initially and hacked at PBS. They hacked PBS's website at least 3 times, and then started going after the affiliates. Well, somehow PBS got wind of this and sent a warning to the affiliates on the 25th, June 25th of last year. My IT guy happened to get that warning. He happened to be at home. He happened to be available, and he happened to stumble across the hackers' Twitter feed. Now, the hackers were sitting there advertising everything they did. Well, we're at such and such a site. No, we're at such and such a site. And when Nick saw them advertise that our website is next, and they supposedly are getting, they found 300,000 records on this website, Nick kind of freaked out. He took the web server immediately offline, called me up, and let's just say that the last phone call I got with somebody as freaked out was when somebody had died. I mean, he was really flipping out about this thing. And that started the whole thing. Our first response is shut down, and I think I... Our first response was shut down the server, take it offline immediately, disconnect it from Ethernet, do everything to take those servers offline. We set up an access control list on the firewall, on the routers, asked the university to set up an access control list, restricting anybody from accessing those servers once we finally did plug it back into the network when we wanted to do some forensics on the system there. We went and notified ASU because this could be a legal issue. It could be a serious thing, so we asked ASU to go through and maintain all logs and everything to preserve all evidence of from the entire land. When we finally got into the building, the first thing we did was pull all the hard drives out of that server and do a forensic backup of those hard drives. And that's essentially a disk copy, a sector by sector disk copy. So there's absolutely nothing that can happen to the evidence on this thing. Put the backup disks back in the server, and then we powered up the server. At that point, we had no idea where they got, what they got into, if they put anything bad in the system. So what we ended up doing is we asked ASU to go through and expire every user ID in the KAET container in Active Directory. We get all of our IT services from ASU. So when you log in to our networks, you're actually authenticating back to Arizona State University's Active Directory system. So after we verified the integrity of the server, we put the servers back online, but again, behind this restricted access control list, so the only people who could see it was our IT administrators and ASU administrators. No, the public could not get to those servers at all. Then we went out, we found the same hacker tools that the hackers used against us. We ran those tools against the server, and the first time we ran it, it ended up with an 85-page report of things that it found wrong with the server. Now, that's not necessarily as bad as it initially sounds, because a lot of the problems it finds are either repeated or those modules are used in various parts of the server. So as you fix one module, it may fix 40 pages of the errors by fixing that one module there. So after we fix the servers, we put the server back online. As I said, when Nick called me, our first response was to ASU. Well, this was a Saturday afternoon. And the people running the help desk on Saturday afternoons are the very low-level folks. We could not get beyond the first-level support folks asking for help. It took ASU 3 days to suddenly realize that we had a problem here. And not only that, but it turned out that once we found out that ASU did, when we got their attention, they had no way of expiring the passwords in any containers, like our container. Because we hadn't heard from ASU initially, we went through and told our own folks to change your passwords. It turned out that it didn't need to happen. We didn't need to change any passwords because first of all, there was no passwords at all on that server. But they didn't really get too far into that server, but we didn't know that at the time. ASU also helped get legal involved and also helped draft press releases and those sort of things, letters to the folks that were affected, et cetera, et cetera. Again, this could have turned into a serious thing, so that's why we got ASU involved into it. Then we started digging in the log files. It took the bad guys only 21 seconds to break into our server from the time they first made a first connection to till the time they got into the thing, which leads us to believe that either they were looking at the server, they were trying to break in one way or the other, or, what I found out later, Google has a hacker database. Google tracks all these servers out there. It's called the DORC, Google Dorks. It's a Google hacking database. And when we dorked ourselves, we suddenly found our server was put up there. And the first thing that showed up under the Google Dorks for our server was the exact way they broke in. So they probably went through and looked up our server here on Google Dorks, and that's the first way they went to. They tried to upload malware to the server 4 different times. Not one of the 4 times did they succeed because of the defense in depth. In fact, ASU was so impressed by the way we had the defense in depth in the server here that, let's just say other parts of ASU don't have that same area. They did download 913 records. In the 3 hours that they were in the server until we found out about them here. And it was kind of interesting how they did it. They started at the back of the database and requested one record at a time, anywhere from 1 to 3 requests a minute in there. I'm sorry, 10 to 30 requests every minute here. And what that did is didn't trip off any alarms if the intrusion detection at ASU was working. Now again, ASU has a very wide access on intrusion protection, so the odds of ASU's intrusion protection system at their firewall probably wouldn't have found, well, obviously it didn't find them, but even if the guys had requested the entire database in one fell swoop, ASU's intrusion protection probably wouldn't have tracked them anyhow. This is exactly what they did. This is a normal request from the web server asking for a specific video clip on the thing. Because we didn't sanitize the input, the bad guys put in all this red information between the between the 22 and the ampersand here in the initial request. I've made all this bad stuff into something that you can read here, which if you know SQL, this is a valid SQL request for one record of data. So what was our response to this? Once we went through the log files, we had to identify what information was taken. Because there was some donor information that was taken out of that, we had to go through and we had to talk to every one of these folks, send letters to all these folks, and if they were major donors, we actually made a phone call. Do not send an email to anybody who is hacked. They've already been victimized one time. The last thing they need to do, they're not going to be too keen on getting an email that says, your information was taken here. We issued new member cards to all the affected folks because one of the things was their member number here. And obviously, we removed all the information off the server here because it wasn't supposed to be there in the first place. What did go right is PBS gave us a heads up that this was happening here. Like I said, Nick, my IT guy, did a wonderful job. He was at home. He wasn't really doing a whole lot of stuff. He was interested, and luckily the hackers put stuff out up on the web or on their Twitter feed that what was happening, what they were doing. We also had defense in depth already set up on all our servers, and that helped mitigate a lot of the stuff that was going on here. What didn't go so right is that database was never supposed to be up there in the first place. I'm sure if that database wasn't up there that we wouldn't have, well, we probably still would have shown up in the DORC database on Google, but there wouldn't have been anything to find. So yeah, they could get into the website, there was no data to get here. We were stunned to find out that ASU couldn't expire passwords. And in fact, this turned into a bigger deal about 6 months or 8 months later when the hackers broke into ASU and took the entire password database out of ASU. They still had no way to expire passwords. And in this time, there was over 75,000 users that had to change their passwords. There was some challenges with that. We could not get past ASU's first level of support. I cannot stress this enough for you. If you rely on another level of support above you, like us with Active Directory, the previous station I worked for was owned by Huge Corporation Inc., and Huge Corporation Inc. had their Active Directory that we all logged into. They maintained Active Directory. If you are in that situation, make sure you have some way to get the total attention of your IT folks up above you. In the last company I worked for, we had if I called up the help desk and said something similar to, this is a blue banana event, every single IT person at Huge Corporation Inc. knew that if they heard somebody say this is a blue banana event or whatever the words they used, everything came to a grinding halt and they got on the phone list until they got whatever help you needed. That was not the case at ASU, and it took a while for us to get ASU to figure that out and fix that challenge. ASU had an intrusion protection system, but it was actually in just monitor mode. It wasn't really, and there was nobody there to monitor what it was screaming about, because they were evaluating several different intrusion protection systems. The other thing is, even if they did have it running, like I said, they can't set up intrusion protection to protect us when it might affect the physics department or it might affect the athletic department. There's so many different users on campus there that have so many different requirements that they can't really set up a restrictive firewall or intrusion protection system anyhow. What we learned here is take security of your web server in-house. We thought that we were protected here, or partially protected here, with ASU's firewall and intrusion protection system. What we didn't know is how limited that protection system was, and it was, again, by design here. Similarly, there's a lot of talk on using the cloud up there for cloud services and so on and so forth. If you decide to use the cloud, be very, very careful, because you have no control over the background, the servers that you're running on. And in a lot of cases, you don't even have a way to audit the people that are managing the cloud for you. So be very careful about that here. If you use student programmers or even professional programmers, make sure that they're aware of good security procedures and how to program to minimize the possibility of bad guys getting into your server. Conduct your own security audits. That means go out and get the same tools that the hackers use, but be very, very careful about that when you do your own security audits. In fact, when you do your security audits, make sure if you've got another IT, like in our case, ASU, or the IT department of Huge Corporation, Inc. that I worked for, make sure they're aware of it when you do a testing, because if they have intrusion protection that's looking for these sort of things, the last thing you want is corporate security or university security folks showing up, somebody's hacking on your website. Well, yeah, that would be us. So make sure they're aware if you're going to do any testing. And also be very careful if you get any tools from the hackers, because a lot of times hackers are hacking themselves. So if they build this wonderful hacker tool to break into servers and they know that people are going to do this, well, that tool may go in and hack your device and put a backdoor into your server. So be very, very careful. Make sure you back up before you do any sort of testing along that line. I highly recommend that all your public-facing devices are sitting behind your own firewall and your own server here. It can't be stressed enough that you should not have, or if you do have any personally identifiable information on your server, it should be encrypted. And even if it includes bank account or credit card information, you can't even encrypt it. It cannot be accessible, period. Like I said, the payment card industry folks have got sets of rules about that tall on everything that you have to do for protecting your servers here. If the worst happens and you're hacked, make sure, don't try to hide it. I mean, the initial intention is to sit there and bury your head in the sand and don't tell anybody that we were hacked. You've got to keep your staff involved. You've got to keep your user base involved. Because as soon as somebody goes to the web server and says, you know, I want to find out when is my favorite program going to be on, azpbs.org, that's not online anymore. What are they going to do? They're going to call up to the front desk, and the front desk is going to call into IT. So if you go through and let the front desk and you let your viewer services folks know that you're offline and this is why you're offline, you're going to prevent them from calling you while you're busier than a little bit trying to pull your servers back together. You do not want them to call you and say, what's happening and when is it going to be back up? If you keep these folks informed ahead of time, they won't be bothering you, or at least they'll minimize the bothering here. Set up a hotline for affected folks to call. And or have them call the main station number here, so that the main published station number, so that there's no question that they're calling your station, as opposed to if the bad guys get in there and set up their own phone numbers or whatever. And the rules are significantly tighter again if you're dealing with payment card industry stuff. Like I said earlier, the original set up for the ASU, for our servers, our web servers, was on the ASU LAN here. These were all publicly accessible, went right through the ASU firewall right to our device. Shortly after this happened, we moved all of our servers up into our own DMZ. That essentially allowed us to manage all the services, that all the requests that have come into the servers, that allowed us to put up our own intrusion protection system, which is tighter than a little bit, and I was stunned to see some of the stuff that we see. I couldn't believe how many requests we get from North Korea, from China, from Russia, folks who have no idea on how they're ever gonna see anything up from a Phoenix public TV station here. We block all of those things at our firewall here. And that's what we assumed was happening at this firewall. Well, we all know what happens when you assume. Make sure you put all the policies that you need in place before you need them. I mean, that sounds very stupid and very simple, but it simply didn't happen. It wasn't done at the university. There was no way at all for us to expire passwords if we needed to, and in this case we didn't need to, and even when the university needed to expire passwords, they had to bring an outside vendor in to show them how to expire all 70,000 users in Active Directory and make them change your passwords. By the way, when that happened, it brought the university to its knees for the better part of 2 weeks while everybody had to change their passwords. Luckily, in our case, all of our equipment was behind our firewall. So none of our equipment authenticates to ASU's Active Directory system. So while the university was at its knees, our equipment here was still operational and we could keep on the air and do business as normal, even though the university was down for the count. Make sure there's a method to get past the help desk, the first line help desk here. Again, that sounds awful. You would think that you could say, hey, we need help, we got hacked, but we just couldn't get any. We couldn't get any sort of help at all from the university initially here. Identify all locations of personally identifiable information. When I started at the university, when I started at the station, that's one of the first things I did. Excuse me. Or thought I did. I went to all the users and say, where is this information kept? Do we keep this information, et cetera, et cetera? And they were saying, oh, yep, it's such and such a server. We don't keep any credit card information. We don't keep any bank account information. We don't keep any of this sort of stuff. It's all protected. Life is good. Trust but verify. I trusted. I didn't verify. We got burned. As I said, the bad guys will find out about it long before you will find out about it here. And let's talk about passwords. How do you force folks to change your passwords? I'm sure everybody has gotten passwords like this. Well, you know what? That may be semi-secure, but who can remember those sort of things? You come up with a password like that in ways. This is actually more secure than this password because you can remember this. You don't find a post-it sitting on top of computers and all that sort of stuff with that, because I remember I like maple and the maple is not equal to a banana. I just remembered my password. There is no way I'm ever going to remember that. The challenge is, in a lot of places, the IT folks have made their information security password policies such that you have to have gibberish passwords like this. So the IT folks over many, many years have required folks to make passwords that they can't remember that are actually easier for computers to break than something that a user can remember that in a way is harder for a computer to break. Because if you do something like this, you can actually have, you know, in a lot of cases, passwords are only required to be 6 or 8 characters long. So if you have a password that's only 6 characters or 8 characters of gibberish, even 8 characters during a brute force attack on here, you can break an 8 character gibberish password in 3 days of working on it. You have a 12 or 15 character password like this that people can actually remember. It takes several thousand years to do a brute force attack on a password like that. So again, in most cases, you guys don't have control over the IT, the ability to set password policies, but it is kind of an interesting thing that I kind of discovered as I was researching this whole thing. Are your log files, are they even turned on? I know an awful lot of places that don't even keep their log files. It's that's all gibberish. It fills up the servers, it fills it out, just turn it all off. Well, you will be very happy you kept your log files when things go rotten. In the best case, you'll take your log files and you'll do what's known as a syslog server. And all your servers, and that's all this does is store log files. So all your servers will send their log files to the syslog server, which does a couple of things. It frees up the disk space on all your servers that you have available out there. And more importantly, if the bad guys do get into your server, the first thing they're going to want to do is erase your log files. They don't want you to know where they got into the machine. If you've moved all your log files to a syslog server, they can't get to the log files. That's a good thing. And even if you are keeping your log files, do you even look at them? I don't believe our folks looked at them that much. We certainly do now. If you go off and use hacker tools, make sure you back up your system. I think I touched on this already. Make sure you have your IT and security folks aware that you're going to be using these tools so you don't run into the your IT or security folks showing up saying, hey, there's somebody hacking at your machine. So run several different tools, because just like antivirus software, there are certain tools are better at looking for certain things than other tools are. You go to the Dork database on Google and it lists everything. So if the bad guys find that you have SQL injection problems, that's the tool they're going to use. If they see that you have cross-site scripting problems, that's the tool you're going to use. And it goes obvious to say, fix any problems you find. As I noted before, don't minimize the implications to your staff or your viewers. And especially, don't minimize it, even if there's no personal information involved. And it's just like, that kind of goes counterintuitive. Well, if you're not releasing any personal information, especially under PCI requirements, why would I want to, I won't say publicly say it, but don't minimize the fact that you're doing it. And this is why. In our case, PCI and public information did not necessarily apply, because yes, and this is the database structure, and I put my own information in here just to make a dummy record here. Note, there was name, addresses, and email address in here, but there was no other credit banking information or social security numbers, any of that sort of stuff. So we don't officially fall under the PCI requirements on here. But like I said, the hacker rules kind of do apply here, because based on this information, they can start phishing for information. And phishing is they take this information. Well, so basically I did. Phishing is where they will send an email to folks looking for information. They'll say, we lost such and such a thing. Can you send us your credit card number, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, how do they do that? Well, they go to our website or go to the website of the folks they want to attack, and they grab a logo, and that's the first part about it. Then they take all the information that they got from the database and they create, here's a header on all this. My name, my address, my member number, et cetera, et cetera, making it look nice and official. Then they come up with their little cover letter that this is why we need all that information that we want from you, et cetera, et cetera. And basically they send it off to all the folks that they got from that database. Well, I use the Carl's mom test to see how well this works. So what does Carl's mom do is she pulls out her gold member card and she looks at the numbers on that and she says, oh, the numbers are there, the address is named, name's right, the address is in them. Well, this has to be from Channel 8, so I'm gonna let them know. I'm gonna tell them whatever they need. Well, how did they, what my mom doesn't realize is that her gold member card and this number came from that same database that the bad guys got. Well, of course it's gonna match. But because it all matches, and this is exactly what social engineering does when they fish for information. They create an email that makes it look like they have your information, and they'll ask for even more information out of the data. And the bottom line is, they end up with all the money and that sort of fun stuff from my mom. So in summary here, make sure you inventory all your systems on the internet. Like I said, trust but verify. Find out what information's on those computers. Is there anything that shouldn't be there? Follow your general IT recommendations. Back up your server, defense in depth. Make sure your computers are patched, et cetera, et cetera. And be prepared for the worst. Because sooner or later, like I said, I was stunned when we put up our own intrusion protection system that we were getting requests from all over the world and places that would have no need to get into our stuff. And is there any questions?
So what was the Twitter feed that your IT guy caught this on?
I have to plead stupidity.
Okay.
I went back and found it. I did this presentation at the PBS Tech Conference back in April. And I knew it back in April, but I couldn't tell you what it is now.
How often for practice do you back up and how do you back up?
We do full backups every week. We do incremental backups every night.
Is there a standardized place where one should be sending these phishing emails one receives? I normally receive probably 3 or 4 a week that I just delete. And I'm just wondering, is anybody interested in seeing those?
I believe the Federal Trade Commission is interested in seeing some of these, but honestly, if they get so many, how would you expect any? I mean, they may look like, they may look for trends. You know, oh, look, we're getting a whole bunch of stuff from Citibank today. But I think I would consider sending them to the security department of the organization that you're getting them from. Because I'll tell you, if somebody called us up and said, you know, we're getting an awful lot of emails here that just don't quite make sense, that in a lot of cases, that kind of trips off an internal investigation. And I know I personally would like to know if somebody's using information, because that way it gives me the opportunity to figure out hopefully where they got the information.
Well, you mentioned there are ways of doing your own security audit. Are you aware there are professional organizations or professional outfits that do security audits and issue a vulnerability report?
I know that now.
Okay.
I didn't back then. And that's also one of those things that it basically boils down to your budget. You know, if you are a standard public TV station, you don't have a whole lot of budget, and you have to look at the information that's supposed to be available on the server. You know, where do I use my budget resources to?
Does the University of Arizona do security evaluations for you independently?
University of Arizona is Tucson. We're Arizona State University. A big fight if you were in Tucson. And
does
you,
the university?
yes and no. They helped us a great deal once we finally got their attention. But there are so many different departments up there because we actually talked to them about when we purchased the tool that we use for evaluating our own server, does it make sense to get a site license that's good for the entire university? Would they be interested in going in with us on buying this tool so they could look at any other server? And they said there's just so many servers out there that they have troubles keeping their head above water to begin with, much less doing security evaluations on all these servers, that even when they found, you know, if in a lot of cases, if they sent an 85-page report to the athletic department that says, you have this problem with your server, the odds are very good that nobody would ever look at it.
One other question, what level of involvement did law enforcement have with this?
I have no idea. I'm a broadcast engineer that got into legal, and once it got into the university's end of the world, I ended up proofing an awful lot of documents, but as far as what law enforcement did or where it got into law enforcement end of the world, I don't know.
Having worked on a university campus for 35 years, university IT is a lot more porous than a lot of companies just because of research. I mean, professors are communicating with, all over the world with people. Plus, you know, even like blocking certain phrases and stuff. You do research, stuff that a corporation would normally block, a university can't because it comes up in research requests and stuff between, you know, stuff. So it's just a little different environment than like in a commercial world or something.
Well, it's not just research. I mean, when I worked for the NBC affiliate, I mean, you couldn't block, you know, sites like the Nazi Party or child porn because people are looking at those sites for doing research on stories. Now, we logged all that stuff, so the staff knew that if I was, you know, if they were going to a site that was doing background on the Nazi Party or something along that line, they made us aware of it. But we couldn't block any of it. I can't really see. Is there any other questions? If not, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.